Right, I think we're ready to begin part two now, if we can. Daniel, Claire, So we're going to race through a couple of things fairly quickly because we are running behind time. But Zoe just asked me to, first of all, we have two speakers in the second half. James Brenton from Cancer Research UK, who's going to talk about the very significant impact that genomics is likely to have on cancer in the coming decade, and indeed some of the things that Cancer Research UK is doing around that. And then we have Alison Hall from the PhD Foundation, which is, I think the best way to describe it, it's probably a genomics think tank, who is going to talk about the ethical, legal and social issues surrounding genomics, so-called ELSI issues. Zoe also asked me just very briefly to talk about some of the areas in which I think genomics is going to be newsworthy coming up. I'm really going to do this whistle stop and we can come back to it if we want to. I think beyond the cancer and ethical social issues, which I'll leave James and Alison to discuss, the big ones are going to the big one is going to be the whole area of pharmacogenomics. This is the use of genetic data to predict the way in which individuals are going to respond to drugs. We already know a fair amount with regard to some drugs. Warfarin is probably the best example, the blood thinner, although we're still not quite at the stage where that's actually clinically actionable, but a lot of people think we're getting very close. I think that whole area of stratified medicine is going to be huge. I think, for example, if you look at something like SSRIs, antidepressants, where you have a very different response among different people, you have as a group, people respond only just a little better than placebo, but you have some people who respond a great deal, some people who respond not at all. I would be surprised if there were not a genetic effect on that. I don't have any data for that, that's my hunch. But I think there will be a lot of cases like that going forward. Disease prediction, we've spoken about a bit already. I don't think we'll ever be in a position where you can actually give somebody a distinct, accurate prediction saying you will get disease X or disease Y going forward. I think what we might get, though, is refined screening based on genetic profiles. So, for example, if your genetic profile suggests that you have a raised risk of prostate cancer, you might then be offered the PSA test and biopsy, whereas if you had a lower risk, you wouldn't. The same with breast cancer, you may get into a situation where people are stratified according to their background genetic risk and then sent for mammography earlier or later according to that genetic risk. From a science perspective, one of the big things that's going to come out over the next few years is answering some of this missing heritability problem. At the moment, we know that a larger number of diseases have a very high heritable component. Take type 2 diabetes as an example, but only a fraction of that. I think diabetes is probably one of the best explained, and we can still only explain about 20% of that heritability there through known genetic variants. As we get to inter-sequencing whole genomes, projects such as the 1000 Genomes Project that Daniel is working on, I think we're going to make some really big inroads into that over the next few years. We're also going to be looking at the genomes of pathogens, things that make us ill, the genomes of other species. You've probably all seen, read with interest, all the stuff about the Neanderthal genome recently. Comparisons between genomes are going to tell us a lot about human evolution and indeed evolution in general. But I think the two biggest issues are the ones we're going to discuss now. So I'll hand over first to James to discuss cancer.
Thank you very much indeed. So just to clarify, of course, from the outset, what we're going to be talking about for the next 10 minutes, and we'll try and make this extremely brief, is the cancer genome and not germline genome that we all inherit. And a lot of this motivation, of course, comes from the motivation of trying to get individualized treatment for patients. In other words, going from technologies that have been around for a couple of hundred years, like microscope, future technologies of about 30 years or so, the use of antibodies to measure specific proteins in cancer. This is HER2 amplification. And then newer technologies, which for the sake of this slide is really around arrays, in which you can measure gene expression or copy number changes in the genome. And the real problem is that in terms of cancer therapy, our therapies are relatively ineffective. I'm not sure what's happened to the colour there, but this says cancer, this is analgesic. So where you have a drug, you know what the target is, and you can make a drug that hits the target, you can get pretty good pain relief. A lot of the medicines using cancer therapy have come from serendipity and screens. The exact target is not known. And we don't know who is the fraction of patients out of those 100 nominal patients you're treating who will actually benefit. And so there has been initiatives around in the US for the past year or so where there are comprehensive attempts to sequence for mutations in the cancer genomes, in other words, DNA from cancers, for targets that may be related to drug therapy. And the benefit of this is trying to get, obviously, better outcomes. So this, again, is extremely small print, but this is just showing that for epidermal growth factor receptor mutations, you can start to get additional benefit from patients, targeting those patients with drugs like gefitinib. Or patients with HER2 amplification, treating those patients with trastuzumab will improve survival. So these are survival curves here where this is duration of survival, this is percentage of patients still alive. The stepwise decline of the curve is just showing the numbers of deaths. So the further across to the right, the more survival. If you go down like this, you are doing less well for this treatment. And just to deconvolute that a little bit more, if you look at all patients treated with a drug like gefitinib, you see these overlapping survival curves. In other words, there appears to be no obvious benefit. Patients aren't doing better compared to standard of care therapy. But if you deconvolute it into the mutation type, suddenly there are survival advantages. If you're not mutated, you don't benefit from the drug. That's this dark black curve here. You die quicker, or rather, you are in a group that doesn't respond. Whereas if you have mutations, you do better. And I don't want to get into complexities, but the mutation here is because patients with mutations in that gene get have a higher affinity for the drug. There are other drivers for bringing this in the UK, mostly because it engenders more UK PLC advantage and more investment. So an example of that is the use of Herceptin trastuzumab in breast cancer, where uptake of the drug made a big uptake in the income of companies running diagnostic tests to measure that amplification. And then from a pharma's perspective, you compare the uptake of drugs like Plavix, which is an anticoagulation drug, 70% of the market, so fitting your sort of blockbuster type mentality. These drugs are much less, but if you're targeting patients with particular mutations, of course you're getting a much higher fraction of those patients who need the drug, and of course that makes drug companies feel happier that they're actually reaching their goals. So what Cancer Research UK is doing is saying that there is a big gap in this area here in the UK. It's happening in other centres around the world. What we need to be able to do is offer these tests to patients in the UK. And we have some comparative advantages over the US, particularly in terms of a national health service and a uniform cradle-to-grave type situation. Contrast that to patients of affluent white background in the US who will frequently fly from the East Coast to the West Coast, have different therapies in different major cancer hospitals. We actually have data and follow-up on patients that is fairly universal. We have good strategies for trying to constrain costs, and I just want to go back to the comment Christy made earlier on. NICE, of course, is about constraining drug use on the basis of evidence. The really important point made in the previous session is that not all discoveries are tests. They don't necessarily have reliability, and we have infrastructures that are perhaps in some cases slightly emerging, but ways of controlling the uptake of the next best thing which everyone is trying to sell. To expand on that for a second, expression profiling tests for breast cancer have become widely taken up in the US. The evidence basis for those tests is still rather limited. And of course, we have other alignment within the oncology field. So what is evolving at the moment, and it is still evolving, is a CRUK initiative in which a workable model for stratified medicine in which patients would be approached and mutations would be measured on tissue from paraffin-based samples is being proposed. And this will combine hospitals, third-party testing labs, National Cancer Networks, but clearly there's a lot of work to do around this in terms of deciding how this will happen at a procedural level, regulatory level, and a protection level in terms of patient care. The model is very much that this is going to be a test. This is offering a test that will become merged in with other tests that are handled by physicians and other health professionals within hospitals. That's fine at a conceptual level. I want to spend the next couple of minutes just pointing out other things that we have discovered in cancer genomes that make some of this model challenging, particularly about how it would be widely applicable. And so I'm going to start with a couple of difficult examples. Ovary cancer is the disease I treat. It's worth just saying that ovary cancer, in most cases, probably doesn't arise from the ovary. And in fact, for the commonest subtype of ovary cancer, it's really arising from the fallopian tube. And that, in contrast to some cancers, the precise genes that cause ovarian cancer are very limited. We don't know very much about what those genes are, and there appear to be many differences between patients. So in terms of offering a gene test for a therapy, we're some way from getting towards that in ovarian cancer. We have actually tried to look for what are called driver mutations, in other words, the key mutations that are associated with development of the disease. TP53, the gene that codes for the protein P53, has widely thought to be important in ovary cancer, but has been relatively poorly measured because it is thought that this would be predictive of outcome and particularly predictive of treatment. In fact, we've done a comprehensive study in two parts where we've looked at outcomes and large population, relatively large population-based series, 100 cases from a larger population. And what we actually find is that all patients with high-grade serous cancer, 94 to 97%, have P53 mutation. So although this is an important gene, defines the disease now, is very unlikely to be predictive for outcome for patients, and of course there aren't actually therapies that we can offer for P53 at the moment, although this sort of work underscores how future work needs to be done. And that's a theme I'd like to leave you with. At the moment, these stratified initiatives will take genes for which we know something about, but clearly there's a huge amount of discovery that needs to be done. And that discovery can go really around cell-based studies, which has been moderately successful over the past 20 years in identifying why patients respond and do not respond, or clinical studies where we take samples from patients during therapy, before and after therapy. And these are going to be critical in terms of deconvoluting what is a very complex cancer genome. One of the questions that we grapple with in ovary cancer is, why does this disease respond relatively well to treatment up front, but most patients die? So 30% survival at 5 years. There are two simple models here for this. One is that at presentation we've got a mixture of cancer cells, or possibly genomes, that both are sensitive and resistant, and you select out resistant cases by your treatment. Other theories focus on the emerging evidence that cancer stem cells or cancer proliferative cells or with stem-like characteristics might be the cause of resistance because they themselves, the stem-like population, is not killed off by treatment, so they still persist but then regrow to cause resistance. We have asked relatively straightforward questions to try and understand what is happening to the cancer genome because actually our hypotheses have been that there is much more evolution within the genome than was previously felt. So to do that, we've taken three sets of cell lines, unique cell lines taken from patients before and after the development of drug resistance. And I just have two slides summarising what we've found from those studies. So these really are a snapshot of the cancer genome before treatment and the snapshot when patients relapse. And if the models hold true, then we would expect to see sequential changes that have occurred with therapy. But we see something very different. These are karyotypes, in other words, fluorescent images of chromosomes from these cell lines before and after treatment. And what you can see here, pre-treatment here, in the sensitive presentation disease, are sort of cut-and-paste abnormalities on the chromosomes. So these should be two green chromosomes, but there's a great big chunk of this blue chromosome here that's been cut and pasted. That has arisen because of DNA damage and chromosome instability. In the relapsed genome, we have normal chromosome 3 here a few months later. Now, that's very unlikely to have occurred going in this direction. It's very troubling because actually if you have this degree of abnormalities up front and you have relatively normal chromosomes or different chromosomes here, you have to ask the question, how did that happen? When we look in higher resolution using array comparative genomic hybridization, in other words, an array technology that allows us to look for aberrations across the chromosomes, we see similar changes. In other words, in the pretreatment case here, this is chromosome 3, this wiggly line here is showing the gains and losses across the chromosome. In other words, how much DNA has been lost and gained as if you'd spread the chromosome out in a long line. There's a large area of loss here on 3q, and the polymorphism data, so this is all those little SNPs that we have that we described in the previous session that say how different we are, those have all been lost. In other words, we just have one copy, effectively, of the chromosome in this whole region of DNA. But in the resistant relapse cases, we have normal heterozygosity. In other words, we have this normal two-chromosome contribution to variability, and indeed we have no loss of this large area of chromosome 3. So you can't go from a loss of the genome to a normal genome. And what this says, and going back to the model, is that what's likely to have happened here is that, yes, the ovarian cancer arose from a common ancestor, but at presentation there was several genomes present within that patient. The bulk of that genome was shown here, and that had disappeared, removed by therapy, but there was very likely to have been a low prevalence genome that had a selective advantage. And so under a selective pressure of chemotherapy, this presumably less fit subpopulation of the cancer genome has managed to evolve and is actually the problem. Is that seen? So there are some challenges around cell line studies. There may be other explanations for that. Do we see these effects in patients? So a study we've done more recently is to multiply biopsy areas of tumour within patients before and during chemotherapy. And when we do that, what we can do is infer the relationship, the evolutionary relationship between these different areas of tumour across the abdomen. And what indeed we find is that these are not highly similar tumours. So this is an evolutionary tree here with an area here close to the ovary, and these are all tissues from the omentum here, and you can see a correlation coefficient here that indicates there's quite a large variation between, quote, early disease, or at least localised disease, and further spread, and that's shown here. So what that data says is there's differences in the genome at presentation. If you biopsy one area of the cancer, there may be actually important differences somewhere else in a different region of the cancer. The problem is with ovary cancer, it's difficult to do that in a very strongly geographical way because there's a lot of disease in multiple areas. What we've also done is asked whether similar changes are seen in the treatment of cervical cancer, using a similar approach by which biopsies are taken at presentation, during treatment, and at the end of chemoradiation treatment here. And this circle here is showing the quadrants by which we've taken tissue from the patient. You have 1 minute.
Yeah.
So this is the uterus here, inside side profile. This is the cervix here. This is the cervix on FAST, as if you're looking at it. So we took 4 biopsies from each quadrant, and we looked to see what happened with treatment. Sorry about the build here, it's very irritating. The striking finding was that you see changes with treatment, where at presentation, shown here, the schematic of the cervix looking face on, is that there are actually 2 cancer genomes within this patient, shown in red and shown in blue. And the precise genetic aberrations are shown here and here. The effect of chemoradiation is that the blue population disappears. A different population becomes present in this quadrant here, which didn't have that population. These data show how dynamic this cancer genome is. It's likely, of course, that in these blue quadrants here, there were low prevalence red populations, and those have been selected for by treatment. So what I've said is that we definitely need to bring forward molecular tests around specific genes for therapy, and that's being done by Cancer Research UK. The challenge is what happens if that genome is changing with treatment. And if we try to go back to a biopsy or a piece of tissue that was 2 or 3 years previously, will that always be informative? It may be for driver mutations, but we need to consider many other changes that might occur. And this is the Cambridge Research Institute, and I'd like to thank Cancer Research UK for their funding. Thank you very much.
Thanks, James. I think we'll move straight on to Alison's presentation, and then we'll take questions together at the end of both, I think.
Right, so my brief is to cover some of the ethical, legal and social issues that we've been discussing this morning, and also give a flavour of a world in which personal genomics is used more routinely in clinical care. So I think some of the problems that arise in relation to personal genomics relate to the fact that some fundamental questions have remained unanswered. And the first fundamental question, I think, that we haven't really properly addressed is the ownership of genetic material in a variety of different contexts, in research context, direct-to-consumer context. So doubts remain about the sort of interests and rights that individuals have over their material. Can they give them away? Can they compromise them just by signing a contract? And this ambiguity arises, I think, because, as has been touched on by a number of people, because of the heritable nature of the material and the fact that parents share part of their genome with their children, with their wider extended family, and with their future children, of course. So is it legitimate to post a genome on a public website or on a website, even if an individual understands the risks involved because of the impact on children and future children? And are the autonomy interests of those children compromised by actions? And how do you reconcile the interests of, for example, parents and teenage children who might both want to keep information secret from each other? And some of these issues were raised for real by Mark when he commented on a family group who had their whole genome sequenced, which consisted of obviously two parents and then a 17 and 14-year-old child. And in that case, it's the case of John West and his family. What happened is that there were safeguards put in place so that the family received extensive genetic counselling, and they also only made the genome of, I think, one parent, the father, publicly available, and then kept the rest for the children to be able to make up their own mind about what they wanted to do. And of course, there are also the interests of wider family members at stake. We've talked about parents, but of course siblings as well. So a second question that arises are the sort of friction that arises where there are multiple ethical and legal claims over data and samples, and perhaps in the context of commercially funded research, where what might be at stake are the economic and political drivers that protect investment, for example, or reward innovation. So the public too, I put public interest down the bottom here, the public too might claim an interest, perhaps an interest in the genomes of celebrities, for example. What attitude should regulators take to that? And how is that public interest different from public health interests in genomes? And again, this was touched on in discussions this morning, about identifying people who might be at risk because of their potential for offending or for self-harming or for by drinking or eating to excess. So another question is the extent of the mechanisms that exist, the legal and legal mechanisms that govern the relationships between the people who supply samples and data and the processors. And individuals who send their samples for analysis, as we've heard, might explicitly choose to compromise those rights through written terms of service, which might transfer ownership of the sample itself or might compromise them in some way. And the terms of engagement are often managed through a written contract and, of course, paying a fee and returning a sample in a bespoke kit. And a raft of different types of regulation apply to that situation. We briefly mentioned some of the situation in the States, but within the UK, legislation like the Data Protection Act, like the IVD Directive, and the Human Tissue Act, and of course advertising standards legislation applies to that relationship, that contractual relationship. Another thing that we might think about is the role of consent, because in healthcare, consent has a special relationship because it's seen to protect the autonomy interests of individuals. But in the context of direct consumer testing, as we've already seen, the context or the robustness of consent, or the idea of using consent, is flawed because partly because of the complexity and the length of the forms that are used, but also what might appear as statements of fact that may be unenforceable. For example, the idea that results won't be used for clinically actionable medical testing. There's nothing to prevent the consumer from using the results they get for something like BRCA to act on those. Another example is that although consumers are asked to confirm their age, that there's no way of validating their age. So I have a teenage daughter who's 14. There's nothing to stop her lying about her age, paying a fee. She's not necessarily competent to make those decisions.
Or you sequencing her.
Yeah, or me sequencing her. We've touched on the issues around global regulation, the fact that many of these services are accessed within the UK, they're accessed from companies who are based in the USA, mean that actually the role of the regulator might be that of a toothless tiger. And I put this up because in the context of human tissue legislation, this was a phrase that was used to describe the role of the regulator by Margot Brazier. And although voluntary agreements such as those that have been put forward by the Human Genetics Commission, for example, the voluntary framework on direct consumer testing goes some way towards providing some framework in the UK, as we've heard from Daniel, the approach of the FDA and the President's Commission on Energy and Commerce just means that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty at the moment about the regulation of direct consumer tests. Patents is another area that is also being litigated about, particularly in the US, and the robustness of patents over genetic tests is uncertain. A district judge in a case that you might have heard about against Myriad, that company was mentioned earlier, found that the patent over the genetic test for BRCA1 was unconstitutional. And so that's thrown the whole issue around patents and the strength of patents up for debate. So the third question I want to ask, or want to highlight really, is what the responsibilities are of people who process samples or data are, the scope of those responsibilities. And we've talked about worries about data security and keeping data confidential. These, in an area of research such as new areas of research are being developed which use samples from thousands of patients, those with diseases and controls, those without, known as genome-wide association studies, which can inevitably combine sharing data, networking and publishing data on an unprecedented scale. And so strictly enforcing obligations to keep data secure and confidential actually might jar with the sort of social networking that was raised by a questioner over there, where consumers who access their genomes on a direct consumer basis actually choose to post them on websites. And there's a sort of clash between those two types of regulation. Moreover, novel data mining techniques mean that claims that data is secure and watertight just aren't true. So nagging worries about sensitive information being leaked to insurers or employers, and providing opportunities for genetic discrimination are likely to be more important over the next few years. An even more vexed question is that of incidental findings, that unanticipated and unlooked for findings should be fed back to consumers and patients. And these are exacerbated, as we said earlier, about worries that when we get gene variant information, that it's not predictive enough because of the combination of genetic and environmental and lifestyle information. And it's a combination of those factors that actually are important to predicting the common complex diseases like diabetes, like heart disease. And of course, unexpected findings aren't limited to health-related findings. They could also include parental incest, and there was a comment about that earlier, or non-paternity or adoption. So, how much?
If you could do a couple of minutes, and okay. Then we'll move on to some questions.
Okay, so I've hurtled through some of these issues. What I wanted to point out was how I think personal genome data will be integrated into clinical care. And as James suggested, I think the likelihood is that these technologies will be important, and Mark, will be important in pharmacogenetics at first, targeting particular drug responses in a small population. But taking a wider picture, looking at whole genome sequencing, the chances are that there will need to be a step change in how clinical care is delivered. There will need to be an emphasis on multidisciplinary working and an emphasis on bioinformatics support. And much of that will depend on funding, of course, will depend on political will, but also will depend on public engagement and public education. Because, as we've mentioned earlier, at the moment, the direct-to-consumer market is directed towards a white middle-class minority. And so there are substantial issues around distributive justice about whether rolling out personal genomics will actually aggravate existing inequalities that already exist within this country. The comments in the Lancet article today, BMJ article today, and also global inequalities too. And finally, just a shameless plug for the organisation, the PhD Foundation that I work for. We're a source of news and comment and also independent reports, and I'll just put our contact details there.
Very useful. Thank you, Alison. Right, I can see a hand's gone up straight away.
Caroline Bloom, a freelance journalist and somebody very interested in the whole issue, since there are friends who've got cancer, friends who've got other illnesses, relations who've had various, parents who've died of various things and grandparents and so on. It affects all of us, I'm sure.
That's for you, yeah.
I just want to sort of make a comparison with something that happened to me recently. There's a company that tries to suggest that we go and have ourselves do various kinds of non-intrusive tests to find out whether we've got other various sorts of illnesses. I got this invitation to go and get myself tested by, I forget what the company was, so I went to my doctor and I said, is it worth paying £150 to have these tests done? Would it be worth doing these tests? Could I find out about these potential illnesses through, you know, the normal way I would talk to my doctor? And what his suggestion was, he looked at what they were going to test me for. This was not genomic, I'm just talking about. This was purely based, non-invasive testing, but with equipment and, you know, blood pressures and various sorts of things. He said, first of all, it's worth going to having these tests done if you can afford it, because all of these things are treatable if these illnesses are found, and all of them would allow you to make changes to your lifestyle in order to reduce your possible damage. Surely the same kind of care is what needs to be applied to any kind of genomic test that anybody might go for. That A, if they find out something, are they going to be inclined and able to do any lifestyle changes and changes to their lifestyle in order to make use of the information? And secondly, would it be treatable if it needed to be, if they found out something, is there something that can be done? Because if no intervention is possible, then we shouldn't be given the information, kind of.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, Daniel mentioned some of the evidence about if you're given this information, how useful is it actually in changing your behaviour? And I'm familiar with some work by Teresa Marteau, who's done quite a bit of work on using genetic risk information to change behaviour. And she likens changing human behaviour to a sort of ocean liner that's really hard to shift. And so not only does there need to be a lot of sort of impetus to change your behaviour, but it's really slow. And I think her work on smoking cessation studies suggests that individuals might respond briefly to the knowledge, but then actually go back to their previous course. And if it's a question of doing more sport or eating more healthily, actually having this knowledge doesn't necessarily change behaviour.
Can I just add to that, actually, as well? I think there's quite good data, at least in the special case of Alzheimer's, where actually, when you're talking about the E4 genotype that Peter was talking about earlier, there may not be treatments for Alzheimer's, but that doesn't mean there's nothing you can do. Actually, knowing that you're at a high risk of Alzheimer's may completely change the way that you approach your middle age. It may change the way that you plan for long-term care. For example, there doesn't necessarily have to be a treatment for that information to be actionable. Martin next, and then Ruth at the front.
Just to sort of comment on that, though, I mean, a lot of the advice for interventions that the tests give, and looking at some of Mark's results as well, very much of the sort of, you know, eat less and move around more variety. Mm. Is it just a case that really all you're doing to an extent is the equivalent of those TV programs where they get everything they've eaten in a week and stick it on the table just to sort of shock them into doing something? So, you know, is it effectively like $1,000 version of that, the impact that it's having?
Yeah. Is 23andMe just Gillian McKeith writ large?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't like to devalue this too much because I think there's an awful lot of potential within cohort studies, for example, to combine information about genetic variants and also lifestyle and environmental information in a prospective way over 20, 30 years and gain some really valuable information about how diseases are caused, which could have a real impact into how we treat.
And I think the view on screening as well, how this could fit into screening, yeah, from a cancer perspective.
Quick question, sorry, just following up, course, is, yeah, that I think that the players who 23andMe may be courting, and I think the comments you made earlier were very interesting, are the HMOs, people who have patients under their care, because then you can, of course, do cohort studies, cross-sectional studies, targeted studies, and thousands and thousands and thousands of patients who are at risk, whereas most of the worried well are not at risk for another 30 years, and a lot of the associations, as you have clearly shown this morning, are not particularly interesting. Screening, I mean, I think that in terms of the disease I treat, ovarian cancer, I remain unconvinced that ultrasound and blood markers will identify what is a relatively rare disease ahead of time to make an impact on mortality, and I think predisposition is going to be a very important part of that. And of course the model is, if we knew who are the 20% of patients who have 80% of the risk, 20% of individuals who have 80% of the risk, then we could target those individuals for additional screening, and ultrasound and serum markers might work well in that cohort. I just don't think it was going to work across the whole group. But that is very much something that has to be driven by well carried out research, peer review, other controls. So I think there is promise, but we're still waiting for those promises to be realised.
Ruth, first of all, actually, do you want to then hand the mic to Zoe, and then we'll take Richard and Clara's. We'll take several questions. I think that's probably easier at this stage.
Hi. Yes. It's Ruth Francis. I work at Nature. It sort of follows up on a couple of the points. I was given the option of having the screen for this session. It was with Decode, so I haven't got the results yet, so I may yet be proved wrong. I chose the cardio, not the cancer scan, because I felt like there was probably more I could do if I did see that there were risks, like move around more, eat better, blah, blah, blah. I also didn't want the guilt that maybe some of the risks involved with certain cancers, if I have a crafty fag or forget to put sun cream on, would the guilt be worse for me stress-wise? There's not a lot of evidence anyway, more than what we already know. So I felt like it wasn't going to make much difference to me and my life to get these tests done versus not knowing. But how easy is it to remove that data if it gets to a point in the future where I just think, actually, you know what, I don't want to know anymore. I want to pull my information out of here, and I don't really want it in any databases anymore. How easy is that going to be?
Good question. Sorry.
Hi, I've got a question for James. You described very eloquently techniques, very sophisticated techniques, to monitor the genome characteristics within a single patient with cancer. In the UK today, how many patients are actually having these techniques as part of their clinical care, and what is in the way of many more patients having that as part of their clinical care?
Okay. James, do you want to start on that?
And we'll start on that. So,
could you bring the mic
over? I mean, I'd make no apologies for showing you a race CGH data in a meeting where we're talking a lot about sequencing. That's not because sequencing is bad or sequencing isn't going to be important. It highlights the gap that exists between microscopy, the far left of that first slide, and some immunohistochemistry, and actually what we know about people's genomes. And unless you're on a very targeted molecular experimental medicine study, these tests aren't being done. We are involved with a project at Cambridge, which is international, which is looking at 2,000 breast cancer cases, led by Carlos Kalnash. The information from those sort of studies will be extremely important in understanding what should happen for the generality of patients with breast cancers. Those findings need to come into tractable tests that are used in the clinic. I think sequencing of candidate genes or sequencing for candidate aberrations, tractable, easy to do. Next generation sequencing has a place, but it's probably still in the discovery phase of experimental medicine studies. But those technologies would be used for high throughput candidate-based studies across 1,000, 2,000 genes.
Okay. Alison, how easy is it to get rid of your data?
Well, Mark, you're probably in a better position to answer this than me, having read the terms and conditions for all the companies that aren't necessarily available to me. But, in general, you would expect to have a right of withdrawal
that's,
of your
that's
data.
That's true. I think they vary in details, but all of them say in the terms and conditions that if you want to get rid of this data, then you can. The spanner in the works, which nearly emerged actually with Decode, because many of you may know Decode is currently in chapter whatever it is bankruptcy, and were Decode to be acquired by a new owner, they would technically be bound to keep that data on, but as we all know, to keep those terms and conditions unchanged, but as we all know. That sort of thing can change. I mean, if they're bought by a company with different ethical standards, perhaps in a different part of the world, then there is every possibility that that kind of thing could happen. I mean, I think the chances of it happening are low, but it's very difficult ever to say never. That ownership of this could not be transferred.
I was just going to add that there's also a question about whether your data has been aggregated with other people's data, in which case it's much more difficult to then extract it, and the extent to which it's been anonymised or de-identified too.
Claire.
Okay, the question I had is for Alison, and I guess it follows on from what we've just been talking about, also Rachel's point and Alice's point about social networking. It's about future-proofing the consequences of genetic information. Now, there's a little button on 23andMe that lets me put my maternal haplogroup on my Facebook page. So once that's out there, it's out there. And at the moment, I could presumably share other genetic data about myself with my friends and talk about it on Facebook and what have you. At the moment, that's pretty innocuous, but, you know, years down the line, you could, associate a particular monogenic disorder or other trait with my haplotype. You know, employers can see it on my Facebook page and what have you. La, la, la. So I guess the question is, how are we going to sort of keep abreast of the rapid pace of science? Because, as we all know, Parliament proceeds at a snail's pace. We have other examples of similar technologies like IVF and the HFEA and things like that. So how do you think, you know, we should go about looking ahead to what, you know, could come out of our genome scans in future?
Can you pass the microphone back to Richard there?
Well,
Should we just take the question, because
okay.
we're already running into lunch. So if we make these the last ones, and then Zoe's got a few words to say.
I'm Richard Grant, right, for The Scientist magazine. 10 years ago, I was working in a company in Cambridge, and we got very excited because we thought we could come up with a genetic test for a particular variant. And you touched on this, James, and Alison actually said pharmacogenomics, but given the current economic climate and given the way that pharmaceutical companies actually have problems getting any drug to market, do you actually think that they'll be interested in segmenting the market like that to develop specific drugs for possibly quite small percentages of the population?
Okay, let's go for Alison first with future proofing.
That's a big question. Of course, regulators grapple with future proofing, and they have done before, as you said, in the context of chimeras and hybrids, human-animal hybrids. I think there are issues around evidence of harm. And of course, at the moment, there's a lot of talk about genetic discrimination, but the evidence of harm that it's genetic information is used by employers negatively is very sparse, at least in this country. And regulators don't like making laws that there's no evidence for. There are also questions around enforceability, and if you make legislation too general, then it may be unenforceable. And certainly in the assisted reproduction situation, you end up with laws that are quite general in tone. Now, I'm not quite sure how that would work through in this context. Or you end up with legislation that's very specifically directed at a narrow sort of sector. So other people have alluded to the medical devices legislation and the consultation that's going around there. I would expect there to be some sort of change in the medical devices legislation.
Right.
Also, advertising is another area in false claims. But I think it's, as I say, future-proofing regulation is a common problem to regulators.
In answer to that question, I think things are changing rapidly in pharma. This idea of the blockbuster has disappeared, particularly in cancer, where highly stratified treatment is going to be important. I mean, it's useful to remember that the biggest cost to pharma is bringing a drug to market which ultimately fails in a phase 3 study. So I think there are several ways this information is going to be used. One, they want to do targeted studies to really know whether the drug is working, to kill that drug if it doesn't have a signal. So the outputs from the Stratified Medicines Initiative, as well as for individual patients, may be very good for better studies that test the drug in the right populations based on existing evidence.
I'm just going to say that was the other thing, is that sometimes a drug fails, in quotes, but then you actually look at the population and find it was effective in that.
The second point is just that, which is that if you've got all these compounds and you suddenly know from the sort of data that comes out from EGFR mutation that there are actually sub cohorts that are relevant, you obviously want to give that drug. And even if you've developed the drug and it's in a niche, you want to target it to the right population. I think the question is going to be, who will pay for that test? And what sort of new partnerships will set up between HMOs, or in this country NHS, and pharma to say, well, who's going to take the risk? And what these sort of innovative things that say, well, we'll have 6 months of treatment and we'll only pay for it if it works.
Of course, one of the slides you showed there had the gefitinib ERESA data on it, and that is a prime example of exactly what you're talking about. ERESA was an AstraZeneca drug, got to phase 3 trials, failed. scientists went back, looked at the data, found there was a subgroup of patients who responded very well. They went back, genotyped their cancers, discovered
Asian
that
smokers.
They were all
female,
all EGFR positive.
They had a mutation at the target site for the drug.
So what has happened effectively is a drug that would have had no market at all and would have been one of the very costly failures that James was talking about is now not the market they'd hoped for, but it's a market. And the other thing I think might happen is potentially drugs which have to be withdrawn because of severe side effects in the subgroup. So, again, I'm speculating here, but it wouldn't surprise me, were Vioxx to have some genetic subtype that causes that kind of heart muscle damage.
If you knew who was at risk.
Exactly.
Then you could target the population. It wasn't, you could re-save all those billions of dollars.
And I would agree with James. I think 5 or 10 years ago, I think pharma did absolutely had no idea about this. But I think now they've seen through it and have actually sort of got to the point where they realise that this is the only game in town, at least in cancer.
At least in cancer, yeah.
Yeah. Great. Go on, Henry, very quickly.
Just to add to that, there's also the point that business models could also include developing tests for the drug as well, so that you're actually...
You're not so much developing just the pharmaceutical itself, but also the means to diagnose and roll it out.
And this is somewhere as well where patent law is going to be very, very important because, the best way to provide these tests will probably be to test for a suite of genes, suite of mutations. You can pay a royalty on a single gene test, but if you're testing for 10 or 100 genes, you might end up with what Francis Collins described to me recently as the $1,000 genome and the $1 million royalty. So, let me hand over to Zoe, and first of all, thanks to Oxford Nanopore for sponsoring this session, which has been terrific.
It's